Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is July 25th, 2005. This session, Liberia, Women Making Peace, presented in the Creekside Room by Lima Gabawi, disc number GBL-2005-01. Let's listen in.
For this opportunity, because there's not, there are not many women who have such an opportunity to come and speak about their experiences. Across Africa, you have a lot of women peace initiatives. I'm grateful that over the last few years, the work of the Liberian women have been really out in the media, in the church, ELC and other churches, Catholic churches and other organizations have really been interested in letting the world know where a group of women in a country where the population is just 3 million but have been devastated by 15 years of war, have been working for peace. So I'm really grateful to God this morning. I started with a prayer, and then now I'm just saying thank you to God. My name is Lima. That's the modernized version of my name. Actually, my name is Lewoma, meaning what is it about me? I'm the fourth girl of 5 girls. My mom was looking for a boy. So by number 4, she was questioning God. Oh God, what is it about me? I can't have a boy. And she never did. Now she has 6 boys, grandchildren. So that's wonderful. I'm a mother of 4. Yesterday, she joked me and said, "You look very young." I said, "Well, I'm not as young as I look. Some old lady that I'm friends with always tell me I still carry my milk cheeks. So it tend to fool people a lot that I'm younger than I actually look. I have 4 kids, 12, 11, 9, and 7. And prior to my coming to do this work, I worked with the Lutheran Church Trauma Healing and Reconciliation Program as case worker. And those days I worked with war wounded ex-child soldiers. These are young people from the ages of 8, 9, 10 who got involved in the fighting, but as a result of their involvement, they have different forms of disability, so I used to help them organize programs and counseling sessions for them. 4 years ago, I felt called to leave that work and go into work with women who have also been victimized as a result of the crisis. Now I work for an organization called the West Africa Network for Peace Building. It's a sub-regional organization that is based in 12 of the 16 West African countries. We have a regional office in Accra, Ghana, and I'm working with the local office in Monrovia, Liberia, where I coordinate the activities of the Women Peace Building Network. Our network is the largest women peace network in Liberia. We are based in 9 of these 15 counties, and we have over 1,000 or 2,000 members. And it's a functional network in that these women carry out and do their own activities. All right. Let me see the hands up. I'm trying so that we can do this in 25 minutes. And then we have 30 minutes of question. And then I sing a song, and maybe we can learn that song, a song of hope, a song of peace, one of the songs that we sing. Singing and storytelling is a form of healing for us as women who have gone through the war. Let me see the hands of all those who know about Liberia, something about the history of Liberia.
You know it's in Africa.
Okay. Was it formed by free slave, American slaves?
Good.
Was it formed by what?
Free American slaves. Okay, so let's go. Liberia, this is the country, is being broken apart slowly because of ethnicity. Every ethnic group now wants a space of a home. Previously, we had 9 counties. Now we have 15, and we have 16 ethnic groups. So in 1820, around the 1800s, when the free slaves abolition law took effect in the USA, they were looking for a place to carry free slaves from America. And they brought them to Liberia in 1820. They arrived on a ship. Our history begins from 1820. Even though there were indigenous people living in Liberia prior to 1820, but everything about those indigenous people, their way of life and everything, nothing has ever been said about Liberia prior to 1820. Between 1822 and 1847, that was the period where they were forming the government. it's good to know that a lot of the free slaves that came to Liberia in the 1800s were half caste, meaning they were fathered by white and their mothers were black. So rumors and gossip has it that a lot of these people who came were children of the real, rich, and powerful whites who knew that if their children stayed in America, chances of them ever becoming powerful would be very slim. So they had to send them to a country where they would be the power behind the throne there. So in 1822, when the free slaves arrived, history says that they came with everything, silverwares, beds, everything they came with it. And in 1847, that was when Liberia was declared an independent country. Our constitution was done here. Our flag is like the American flag, except that we have only one star. Our capital city is named after the former president, James Monroe. We have three branches of government, executive, legislative, and judiciary. We, for a long time, from the 1800s up until 1980, used the American currency. So today it's used side by side with the Liberian currency. So if you went to Liberia and didn't have any Liberian money, you didn't have to worry, because you can walk into the supermarket and pick your goods, and then they will transfer, do the conversion into US dollars, and you can pay in dollars. As a matter of fact, most of the stores we go to buy in charge US dollars. So for a long time, this is what we went through. And the American Liberians, when they came, they took the best land. Most of the land here in Montserrado, so most of the lands around here, the best farming land and all of that, they took it. They also, what was meted out against them and their families as slaves was what they did to the indigenous people. So for a long time, the indigenous people were slaves to the American Liberians. Indigenous property owners and elite women were not allowed to vote until 1948, from 1847 to 1948. Between 1950 and 1979, that was the period called the period of the progressives. Most of the American Liberians that came would pass in a village and see a little girl like myself, beautiful, and take her and say, "This is my daughter." And the parents had no say about that. And they would take that child, change her name, send her to the best school, and later us send her to the USA for college. These young people between 1950 and 1979 or 1970 came to the States, to Germany, to England, when that was the period of the civil rights movement. People were questioning their identity. They went back questioning their identity. Where did I come from? Why is my name like this? Who are my original parents? So later on, they started exposing some of the issues of corruption, injustices. But prior to that, Liberia was seen as one of the most peaceful countries in Africa. But this year is the conflict continuum. Here in peace building, they will say the conflict was latent. All of the issues that should have led to crisis or war was there. Suppression, oppression, nepotism, ethnicity, tribalism, everything was here. But people still called Liberia the most peaceful nation in Africa. So by 1979, these young people now started going back to their culture, wearing their cultural things, doing a lot of things. And then they started challenging the status quo in society. We want to go to universities. If you had my last name, which is Bowie, which is a typical African name, you could not be admitted into the University of Liberia. One of my former colleagues' husband shared with us, when he came from Lofa, he went to school here in the north and came down to his grades were very good because he had been educated by Lutheran missionaries. So afterwards, he told them his ambition was to come and go to the university. He came down with all of the support from the church, went to meet the admission officer at the university, and they asked him, "What is your name?" He said, "My name is Henry Flomo Gwese." "Flomo what?" "Gwese." "Flomo what?" "Gwese." "No, boy, you ain't coming here. You need to change your name to either a Cooper or a Dennis or something if you want to be admitted in this school." For him, it was really strange. That was his first encounter with sectionalism or whatever name they may call it, and he was not allowed in the university until this period of the progressives. In 1979, that was when we saw our first form of violence. There was a rice riot. In 1980, the duly elected government, an American Liberian, William R. Talbot, was killed in a coup. 1985, American Liberians tried to come and take power, the coup failed. They used these people from Nima area to launch that attack. And when they failed, the then President Doe was from this Grand area. He launched a full-scale attack. Hundreds of the people living in this town, in this county, were killed, especially the educated ones. 1989, December 24th, Charles Taylor, that is the name that a lot of the people in the world finally knew Liberia by, who was supposedly in prison in the USA, broke jail and started a rebel incursion in Liberia. How he broke jail, don't ask me. So the rebel incursion started again from Nima, and here is Sierra Leone, here is Guinea, here is the Ivory Coast, and here is the Atlantic Ocean. So the rebel incursion started. So enter Sierra Leone from Liberia, you can enter either from here, here, here. We have so, the border points are so porous. You can also enter Guinea from here, here, here. You can enter the Ivory Coast from here, and here. That's how porous our borders areas are. So the rebels came from a little town here by the Ivory Coast. This town was called Buto. And they started coming from 1989, December 24th, and they didn't get to the capital, Monrovia, until July 1990. But still, they could not take over the capital, Monrovia. For a long time, we went through intermittent crisis. 1992, Charles Taylor launched another full-scale attack on Monserrado called the Operation Octopus. 1994, there was a lot of killing, massacres in these areas, the southeastern areas. 1996, there was another attack on Monrovia called the April 6th attack. And then 1998, we had the September 11th attack. 1999, another group of rebels came through Guinea by Lofa and started waging war on the Taylor-led government. Because in 1997, Taylor won the elections. Liberians got in the street and said, whether you kill my mom or my pa, we will still vote for you. That was their way of saying we're tired with the war. We'll put anyone there if it meant it would give us peace. They took a tyrant and made him president. By 2000, this war started coming down. By 2000 and 2001, Taylor had supported, as president of Liberia, rebels from here to go launch a rebel incursion in the Ivory Coast. As a way to pay back, the Ivorian government paid some rebels and they came and launched an attack here. But the people that the Ivorians used were people from this Grand Gilet area because there's a history of hate between Day and the Taylor government. So that's been the back and forth thing. The Guinean government supported rebels into here, and then Taylor was using people from here to go back into Guinea. No, sorry. He was using people from here to go back into Guinea to launch an attack. In 1992, he successfully launched attacks from this area into Sierra Leone. And the Sierra Leone war is something that when you go to the website and read about, was one of the most vicious civil war West Africa has seen. They would enter a village and hack the limbs of everyone, including 2-month-old babies. So by the time these fighters were disarmed in Sierra Leone, they joined the fighting in Lofa to come and attack Taylor. So we have a whole group of young people who are just mercenaries within the Mano River sub-basin. You have a question?
Yeah, I do. Taylor is being the first person that came, started the initiator of everything. What was his platform?
We always hear rampant corruption,
mm-hmm.
injustice.
Right.
The wealth of the nation is not going to the poor, and all of the things that politicians
right.
will bring was the same language that he spoke to us when he came. And young people were carried away because on Wednesday, I'm doing something with the high school and junior high school students where we look at the role of the youth in the crisis. Young people in Africa, West Africa, have little or no say in governance, in community issues. Children are to be seen and not heard. And this dissatisfaction have been their way of expressing that they have been marginalized over a long period by getting involved in the conflict. Anyway, by the time the war came to 2002, what was the women's involvement? Between the 1990s to 1994, you saw women's group organizing more or less like baking food, taking it to internally displaced people, providing shelter for people, going to prayer and having night candlelight vigils for those who were suffering as a result of the war. They were not actively involved in the politics and all of the happenings of the crisis. By 1994, some of the elite women, meaning Americo Liberian descent, decided they had to do something. They started doing more or less what we call in peace building, more and track one diplomacy, going from country to country around Sierra Leone, Guinea, Ivory Coast, Ghana, to talk to the leaders there to let them have a say. And most often, their initiative, though noteworthy, never really filtered down to the rural people, grassroots women, community women. It was still up there and kind of like seen as an elitist thing. By 2001, 2002, we had organized the Women Peace Building Network. And as part of our network, our role was to build the capacity of women in holistic peace building, meaning we were going to the villages and towns and really talking with women to see how we could use what they already had in their culture to promote and enhance peace in their communities. By 2003, January, we had a dialogue, a Christian-Muslim dialogue between both the Muslim women and the Christian women. At the end of that dialogue, the women signed a memorandum of understanding that every issue that tend to affect their society, they will work together on it. March 2003, that was when I resigned my job at the Lutheran Church. Not knowing where I was going, I just, okay, I will go to the women's office on a daily basis to volunteer. That day, I'm sitting and my phone ring. They called me and said, you need to come to the office. The Christians and the Muslims, they form a delegation. They are here. I went to the office and they said to me, we are a bit concerned about what is happening. At the time, this war that had started in the north had come down to here. They've managed to take this area, this area, this area, and they were moving into Monrovia. The tactics now was that the rebels would attack surveillance area. As we are sitting here, they will launch an attack, enter the room, take all of the beautiful young girls that they would take because they were their wives, take every valuable item we had here and go. And then the government will come as a means of saving the people, come and line up men, you are supporter, and kill them. Take some of the young women too. So civilians were being harmed from both sides. So the women came and said, what can we do? They said, what can we do? They said, well, we want to start an initiative, but we want you to coordinate, meaning the Women Peace Building Network to coordinate. We said, okay, we'll do that. What do we do? The first thing was, let's issue a statement condemning this war. So how do we take this statement to all of the radio and television stations when we don't have the funding? Someone took out a $10. That was the beginning of the campaign. We issued that statement that day. The very next day, we came together because it was a success. Every radio station was playing the statement. We decided, do we want this network to just remain amongst us? Just a handful of women, or do we want it to spread? We said, let's invite other people, other churches, other Muslim sects, other tribes, officials' wives, let them just come. So we put the announcement on air that we're having a mass meeting for the mass action campaign. And that day, we expected 75 to 50 persons. We got 250 women to come to that meeting. That was the beginning of the Women of Liberia Mass Action for Peace. Those women elected 20 of us and said, these are the organizers. You are the ones who will go out there. You will plan the program on a day-to-day basis of what we're supposed to do. and then you come to us and we'll implement. And then we had another group for mobilization. So by the first day, we called a program on April 11th. And that program was where we're supposed to, we were presenting a paper to President Taylor. We did 5 letters of invitation for him because there was a culture of, I didn't see any letter. So we took one to his office, we gave one to his brother, we gave one to the Minister of Foreign Affairs, we gave one to the President Pro Tem, and we gave one to his wife. So there was no way he could say that he didn't see one, any copy of that letter. He didn't come to the program that day, even though we expected it. The women said, what do? We still read our statement. In our statement, we were calling for unconditional ceasefire, immediate unconditional ceasefire, fruitful dialogue between the government, the rebels, and the deployment of an intervention force. 3 days later, President Taylor passed us by. We had gone and sat in an open field, which is now known as the Peace Field in Liberia. From the airport, you pass by that field. It was on the way to President Taylor's. From his house, he would pass by the field. So we took that location strategically so that we could appeal to his conscience if he had any. On the first day he passed, he saw us. He didn't stop. The second day he passed and saw us. The third day he passed, and that was the last time President Taylor passed that area to go to work for as long as we were sitting there. When we didn't hear from him, we went to Parliament. We took our petition to Parliament. On this day at Parliament, the Speaker of Parliament came, it was raining, but women took their babies out. And then they said to us, can you please come under the shed? And most of the mothers of children said no. Because when we have to run from the displaced camps, when we have to run from our homes and it's raining, none of you take umbrella and put over our children. We run under the rain. Our protest for peace with our children, we will do under the rain. The Speaker of Parliament got upset. Who is the leader of this group? I got up and said, I am, sir. Why do you want to embarrass this government? I said, sir, the government is already embarrassed. Don't tell me that. By that time, my patience had run up. I will tell you whatever. The press got interested. As he insulted me, I gave it back to him. So they kept the mic from one person to the other, and the rolling was going. He was really very angry. Finally, one of the older women came and stood between us and said, this is not right. He said, but this is an embarrassment. The pro temp of the Senate, who was a close aide to Taylor, came down. She took our petition and said, I will go to him. We said to her, 3 days, we'll come back. We went 3 other times, meaning 9 days, and we never got any response. Finally, one day, we're sitting on the open field, praying, fasting. And then the Speaker of Parliament comes and sent his bodyguard, go and call the leader of this group. And the bodyguard came and said, who is the leader? I said, I am. My boss said you should walk to the car. I said, go and tell your boss. As he is Speaker at Parliament, I am the boss here. He wants to see me, he walks to me. He got down from the car and came, where is this frisky little girl? I said, yeah, and he said, you know, this thing doesn't have to be like this. We can still be friends, we can still work together. And then he said, President Taylor will see you all on so and so day. The morning that we're supposed to see President Taylor, we got to the executive mansion and went to the security and said, we have a meeting with the president at 10 o'clock this morning. The security said, oh yes, the women. President Taylor say, we should allow you all to enter this place only if you are more than 25. President Taylor did not expect that women would stand up to his oppressive regime. So I said, when we are more than 25 years, so if we are 100, he said, y'all can come. But I doubt if y'all will be 100. You know, in a typical Liberian English, I said, okay. When I crossed the street to the University of Liberia, where over 4,000 women had gathered that day. So let's form a line. And we started coming. It's up on a hill. So as we were coming down the hill, all we could hear the security say, my God, these women are really serious. We got there, we sat down, but then the fear. A lot of the older women started going to the bathroom fast. Some people's pressure started going up because they really didn't know what this tyrant would do with a group of women. But we kept praying and praying. Finally, they came down and said, President Taylor, we'll see you all. He said, but he will only see 7 persons in his office. I said, I'm going up there to tell President Taylor my mind. And he said, what are you going to do? I'm telling him we will not talk with him unless he comes down and see the whole group. These women, they didn't come from their homes for seven persons to go in his office and come back and say, President Taylor, say. Finally, we decided to go up. As we're going up, the security came running down. No, President Taylor said you should go back. He's coming down. So he came down, sat down, offered us seats. We refused politely. And he said, why? We said, because if we are walking under the rain and leaving our homes because of the war, we won't take chairs along with us. We met him, and then he said to us, the only way I will believe in your movement unless you find the rebels and tell them what you've said to me. But I finally agreed, because I've seen my mother and grandmothers in the sun and rain, I will go to a peace talk. So that was our challenge, to send a group to Sierra Leone where the rebels were based. Where will we find the money from? Because already the campaign was costing us $500 a day. Where did we get that kind of money from? School children, taxi drivers, bus drivers, marketeers, bishops, imams. People just came. As we sat, cars would stop, and you see someone coming. This is $500 Liberian. It's our family's contribution. School children would come, take all of their lunch money, put it into one thing, and bring it to us. The Archbishop of the Catholic Church, I must note here, was very instrumental in our fundraising. He called a meeting of all of the political parties and said, I think you all should support this women's venture. Because when peace is here, you forget that it ever existed and you'll be scrambling for jobs. They did. We got a lot of money at the time. But then where will we take money from to send these women to Sierra Leone? The Lutheran Church in Liberia had just completed their partners meeting, and some of the partners were still there. The ELCA, the Church of Sweden, and the Church of Denmark. So they called us and wanted to hear what our movement was all about. We went and explained to them. The Church of Sweden gave us $5,000 on that day. We took that money, and 3,000 of it, and sent the women to Sierra Leone. They met the rebels and presented their petition. Then we heard there was a peace talk in Accra. Archbishop Francis had gone to the UN and said to them, I would like these women who have been protesting to represent the grassroots women at the peace talk. The UN said to him, no. Our policy is that we can only work with people we know. We don't know these women, and they are not going at the peace talk. We didn't see it as anything to discourage us. We saw it as a challenge. Just as we were preparing, looking for money to go to the peace talk, the Church of Denmark came with $5,000 to us. So we had 7,000. With 7,000, we gathered seven women and went off to Accra. We got to Accra because there's a population of 30,000 Liberian refugees in Ghana. We were able to mobilize about 250 Liberian women, and we staged a protest from June 4th, 2003 until August 15, 2003, for 3 months. Every morning, the warlords, the government officials came outside. They saw us sitting there in white with our placards. It wasn't easy psychologically because the country was being shelled on a day-to-day basis. We had women sitting by us who had their young children back home. We had mothers who had their children there. I had my father there because my children were living in Ghana. But it was a real traumatic experience for us. We started running out of money, as we thought we would be there for maybe 1 or 2 weeks. But God was faithful through it all. And as we continue our protest action, every day it became evident to us that this was the work that God wanted us to do for Liberia. Because he provided, when we were on to our last $100, someone would just pass and say, here is something for food for the women. Every day he provided for us. The peace talk dragged from June to July 24th. The killings continued in Monrovia. On July 25th, we went to the peace talk as women, and the emotions were high because news of death had come in more than the hundreds from one center where people had gone to take refuge. That morning, we got there, and I went to General Abubakar, who everyone now knew us and knew me, so he called me General Lema. General Abubakar is the former Nigerian president. He was the chief mediator for the peace talk. And I said, good morning, General. He said, good morning, General. I said, General, when are you starting this morning? He said, we are starting at 10. Do you want to sit in a session? Because he said to me, anytime you feel like sitting in, you can sit. I said, no, General, I just want to know. He said, oh, 10 o'clock will start. I went to the press from BBC, VOA, and said to them, you guys don't want to go today. Don't leave this area. Why? Today is showdown. Oh, Lema, what are you going to do? Say, just sit and watch. 10 o'clock, all of the delegates, all of the warring parties entered the conference hall. I went and sat at a table and wrote a nice letter. Then I told the women, come and sit at the edge of the door. All of the entry points of the conference hall, we sat as women. And the way we sat was like this, hooking our arms together. Then I tapped on the back of the door like this. And General Williams, one of the Nigerian Army generals, turned. I said, I want to see you. He said, well, I said, I have something. I shook the paper to him. And he said, okay. He came. Please give this to General Abubakar. He took it and carried it. General Abubakar opened. He said, ladies and gentlemen, I'm sad to announce to all of you that we are under siege. General Lema and her troops have taken over the conference hall. In that letter, we were saying we were not allowing any Liberian to come out of the room unless a peace agreement was signed. If it took 10 days, no food or water would go into that room because we want them to feel exactly as our parents, our children, our grandparents were feeling in Liberia. General Abubakar came out, but before he could come out, one of the military guys came, say, who is the leader? I am. We're taking you to prison. Why do you want to obstruct justice? I said, yeah. He said, yes. Grabbed me by both arms, and these two very heavy military men took me. I said, please wait. I want to make this very easy for you. Say, hey, madam, what do you want to do? I said, I don't want you, when you get to the prison, to worry about anything. So I will strip and be naked before we get to the prison. I took off my hair tie, took off my blouse. By the time I grabbed my wrapper, the traditional cloth, they all ran away. Because in our, you cannot, I'm Liberian. These are Ghanaian security officers. It's complete bad luck culturally to see a woman's nakedness, a woman that you're not married to. They left me so fast. I thought lightning had hit them. And then this Liberian man came and took my t-shirt and put it back on me, took my hair tie. But standing by me, our advisor, is also undressing. And all of the women said they were about to follow suit. So they were going to have 250 plus naked women on their hands. So when, by the time General Abubakar came out, I was crying, furious. He grabbed me on one side, the Ghanaian ambassador grabbed me and said, let's go. We entered the room. And those people allowed me to cry. All of the emotions I had been carrying from April up until July. When I look, General was crying, and the ambassador was crying. Everyone in that room was just crying. Meanwhile, the delegates were sitting there. Strangely, these men who gave young people guns, just a few handful of women sitting and barricading a door, they opened the windows and started jumping out. Then the same Ghanaian security forces who were taking me to prison earlier on came and said to the women, send some women there, they are running away. So some of the women went and stood by the window so no one could get out. For 2 hours, 30 minutes, they negotiated with us. And it felt powerful. You know, I understood the psychology of those men and women in that room, that the world eyes were on them and they were taking their own sweet time, even though the lives of people were involved.
So we gave our conditions to 1, 2, 3, 4. And from that July 25th up until August 15th, the peace conference was sober. There were not much drinking beer and champagne and young girls, half naked girls around our warlords. As a matter of fact, they avoided where we sat. Because we said every time, and any time any one of them passed and gave us a bad eye, we were coming back. They avoided that area. But 2 weeks later, a comprehensive peace agreement was signed. We went back to Liberia, celebrating the peace, but also being very mindful that we had to watch the peace. From that 2003 August up until today, we continue our campaign. We were there in the camps, taking our sons and daughters to be disarmed. In some of the areas, it was very beautiful. One of the commentators from the UN News Radio said he came to Basra here, where the young people were being taken to be disarmed. He said in all of his history, work history as someone covering disarmament, the women formed a line this way and formed a line this way, all in white. And the fighters were in the middle with their arms, and their mothers chanted and sang songs of praises to God as they took these young people to be disarmed. We were there when problems arose as a result of appointments in government. We've been there telling people to go out and register to vote because Liberians have sunk into a state of apathy, especially as it relates to governance. People don't want to vote because the governments from 1822 up until today have never benefited the people. So people are now saying, what is the essence of getting involved in politics? What is the essence of casting a vote? But we as women have been out there telling people, go out, register, come and vote on that day. Just vote your conscience. We've managed to get in the electoral law, the law guiding political parties, that every political party that put forth candidates, minimum 30% should be women before they get accepted by the Elections Commission. We've gotten a new law on rape already drafted. Next month, we start the campaign to Parliament to see that it's passed into law. Our work has been very challenging in that we had ethnic, religious divide to cover. We had a lot of other challenges, but God being on our side, we were able and we are still able to continue our campaign. What is the hope for the future? December, we're hoping to launch. Late November into December, we'll start a series of consultations where we develop a national agenda for women's community peace building to be presented to whoever wins elections this October. We want to see women more involved in their communities, in their different areas, in building peace and preventing conflict. This is where we are. And someone may ask, what is the drive? If I threw that question back to any one of you, if you were in that situation, what would be your drive?
Certainly for the peace that you're looking for, justice.
But for us as women, in as much as we wanted peace and justice, the practical thing was being tired, waking up in the morning and watch your baby die from hunger. Being tired of seeing a truck pull up in your yard and five of your young daughters are taken away to be raped by several men. We were tired seeing our young boys walking, coming from school and thrown into pickups. They were being constricted to go and fight. We were tired of our husbands hiding under the beds while we went out there and provided for them. We were tired of the uncertainty of the future. Life was not just good to us. And we thought it was in our hands to do something about the future and the future of our children. For me, I got involved because I said to myself, I was 17 when this war started. And all of my life, I've seen nothing but death, destruction, and heartache. I don't want that for my children. So being in the forefront or being on the front line for peace, that is my drive. That never again should we as a people go through what we went through. I'll stop here for now. If you have questions, comments.
this group, as you did this morning, the story of how you, you know, how you grew up and how you got involved in this?
Okay. Well, I am from a middle-class Liberian family. My mother is a descendant of American Liberian, but she was disowned by her family when she decided to get married to an indigenous person. So now they're calling her back, but she's not interested, according to her. I was 17, fresh out of high school. I had gotten admitted in the University of Liberia doing chemistry and biology. My ambition was to become a medical doctor, specifically a pediatrician. And that July morning, July 3rd, 1990, my mom got in her car and drove off to work. My dad had gone earlier. My sisters had classes at the university. And I didn't really have any class that day. So I decided later on I would take a taxi, go to town to hang out with my friends. And that was the last I saw of my family for 2 weeks, my mom and my sisters. I stayed in the house with my youngest sister, my two nieces, my nephew, and my cousin. We had other extended family members staying in the house with us. That morning, as we were moving from one area to the other, by 10:30, we heard this heavy shooting, loud explosion. And then the bullets started raining over the house like real rain. All over, you could just hear the bullets passing. And these young, my nieces and nephew were out, and my brothers and sisters playing in the sand. What I watched was all of the adults that stayed in my house running to grab their own children. And these young children were left there. I'm standing at the back door and looking and saying to myself, okay, somebody will go back and take them. No one went back out. I had to go out, pick these children up, run in with one group, go back for the other. I went and sat in the room for a long time and said to myself, this is growing up time. There's no mommy or daddy to depend on now. It's only you. So that night, I took the kids. We went into my parents' room. That's where we slept. The next morning, I woke up. My aunt was going to the pantry to prepare breakfast. I asked her, what are you doing? She said, I'm going to grab some food. I said, 1 minute, as of today. Anybody wanting anything in this house have to ask me. I realized I had to take over. If we ran out of food, I would be left with these children. So I thought, okay. So for 2 weeks, I ran the house. More people kept coming. We had over 50 persons in the house, internally displaced people. People kept coming and coming. I had to make sure that they had a little space where they and their children could lie down. This morning, I saw my mom coming. No car, no shoes, jewelry, everything had been taken. And then I said, oh, thank God. And she's like, I don't have the energy. You just have to continue the way you started. We stayed in that community. After a while, we moved to town to the Lutheran church because it got unsafe for us. And this day, we decided to go and look for food, my cousin and I. And that morning, we sat in one little house where they shot for almost 2 hours over our heads. There was intense fighting. Finally, they ceased fire. We came out and ran back. When I got there, my mom had slipped into this traumatic state. What they explained was that earlier in the day, as she was sitting in front of the house, she got up to stretch, and then she saw this man digging in the dirt, the pile of dirt. And then she said, what are you doing through the fence? And he said, I'm looking for food for my children. And the food that he was talking about was palm kernels. He was taking those kernels back home where they would crack open and his kids would chew on it and drink water to sleep. So she said, palm kernels? He said, yes. Is that all that your children will eat tonight? He said, yes. She said, come. She took 5 cups of rice and gave to him. And then she went and sat down. Less than 2 minutes, a car drove up to this man filled with armed men. And they were asking him, where did you take that rice from? He's afraid to say, she gave it to me, because they will come in and raid the house. So he's just standing there and says, someone gave it to me. Who? Someone gave it to me. Who? Someone gave it to me. And she stood up and looked, but then she said, strangely, she couldn't talk because she was so shocked. And these people shot and killed that guy and took the 5 cups of rice from him. When they drove away, my mom now put her hands on her head and said, I killed him. I killed him. If I hadn't given him 5 cups of rice, he would still be alive with his children. I came that day and she couldn't stop crying. But then afterwards, she couldn't just think. I don't know if you've ever encountered traumatized patients. They're just in that state of numbness. So I had to like hold her hand and say, let's go here, let's go there. So from 17, I did that for almost 2 years. 3 years until I was 20. I got so angry at God. Why would you allow us to go through all of this? My little sister would pass around the house. She was 9 years old. And they had just celebrated Easter. So she had learned this Catholic song because she went to a Catholic school. And she would sing that song every day and would upset me. The song went like this. My Lord, he died for his kingdom to redeem the hearts of men. Now, my people, don't you weep. The Lord is raising from his sleep. He lives again. Hallelujah. Sing hallelujah. Christ the Lord is risen. He is risen indeed. Hallelujah. And I'll go like fatter. I will beat the living day like all of you if you don't shut up. But at night, when I close my eyes to sleep, that song would keep ringing in my ears. And we left and went to Accra, Ghana. And then I met this friend who started ministering to me. But it really didn't dawn on me until we started receiving a group of our friends from high school, because we were very close and our parents kept close contact. And then I met this girl, Lydia, and her sister, Linda. By the time they came, Lydia, Linda, yay, you are finally out of Liberia. And they were like, yes. Where is your dad? Because their father was the fired brand in the Parents Teacher Association. Mr. Brehun will see you anywhere. Even if your parents were not there, say, what are you doing here? Your mom know you are here. If you don't have a real answer for you, he has your ears. So say, where is Larry? Because that's how we used to call him by his first name. And they started crying. Their dad, because of his Ghanaian descent, was hacked to pieces in front of them. And his body was placed in a bucket and given to the older sister, Linda, to go and bury. Linda lost her mind. Till this day, she does nothing but just sit and look around. Lydia is the strong one. We met another friend who came 2 days later, Trish. So as my friends started coming and explaining their stories, I said, God, I must be very ungrateful. I was never raped. None of my family members suffered severe, violence. Just being uprooted from my home, I'm carrying such anger. You have to find some place to forgive me, God. And that was the coming back for me. Any other question?
How big is Liberia compared to some of the other countries in Africa?
Liberia is a tiny, just to give you an idea, with a population of 3 million people. In West Africa, we are one of the smallest countries. I think Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Togo, these are the smallest. In terms of size, I don't know.
Is this movement that's going on in Liberia now, is it going to affect some of the other countries in Africa?
The women's movement? Hopefully. Guinea-Bissau. Guinea-Bissau is another country up here. The women have started a movement that is really powerful. On elections day this year in Guinea-Bissau, there were violence on the streets, so the women went and barricaded the polling areas and said no one will vote until the violence all there stopped. It stopped. So gradually it's moving, but some areas are still where you would think that the women would rise up. In Nigeria, in the northern part, and most often, what I've seen in my work in West Africa is that countries that are more or less peaceful, people are not really interested in building community peace. You go to Ghana now, they have crisis in the north, but women in the Accra area and other areas are not bothered by it because the conflict is still far away. Let's be honest. This incursion started in 1999. When did we get involved? 2003. because our comfort zone was being threatened. That's the way most people would react. If you heard a town out there is burning, on the first day you feel sorry, and by day three you are not interested in again. I mean, that's the normal human tendency. Until you hear the fire is moving towards holding, then everyone is, oh my God, I thought, you know, they worked on it. Yes.
I don't know, I'm not sure. Maybe somewhere in 2003 until last year, there have been some UN United Nations.
15,000 of them. They are all over the place. The largest peacekeeping.
Are they still there?
Yes, the largest peacekeeping force in the world is currently in Liberia. 15,000 strong men and women.
There may be.
Oh, they are.
I've seen some. I mean, some UN forces.
They are there.
Are they still there?
And there was this pastor from the Lutheran Church who went on the internet and read about a movement from Namibia. And he came to Liberia as the chaplain of the Namibian contingent.
Okay.
And this man had my picture everywhere. Do you know this woman? And everybody is like, oh, that's Lima. But they would never tell him she's there. This Sunday, I'm at home and my dad called and said, you have to come to church because you have 75 peacekeepers from Namibia here saying they are your guests. Peacekeepers from Namibia, I have never encountered. And he said, these people say they are here purposely to see you. They want to see the woman who started the peace movement. And I came to church and walked up to the guy. I said, I understand you are looking for. He said, no, I'm not looking for you. I'm looking for Lima. I said, I'm Lima. He said, but you are just a little girl. And I said, yes, I am. And he hugged me. But we kept a close contact until they changed that group around. They are gone now, but there's still another group. The Namibian contingent are based here in Tubmanburg, Bomi County. That's where they're based.
My brother was also there.
Okay. Yeah. But you know, they're not, they don't encounter, I mean, this peacekeeping troop is really, really blessed. Unlike previous peacekeeping troops, because people are really very tired with the war, so they haven't really gone through a period of violence, except for last October when there was a Christian Muslim thing where they had the burning of churches and mosques back and forth. Then the Nigerian contingent got involved because they were predominantly Muslim. They started protecting Muslim homes only, and then the Ghanaians felt obligated to Christians and they started protecting Christian homes. But it was really very bad. To this day, some of the communities are still heavily guarded.
I have another question. Some time ago I heard that the Christian church is growing faster in Africa than any other part of the world. Is that a true statement?
Yes. And sometimes it's confusing too, because you're sitting here in your church and you are singing and next to someone is preaching. When in another church. And when that preaching has ended and you are preaching, they are singing. You know, so you have churches, Christian churches all over. And I think more or less, because of the hardship, people tend to relate more to, and I'm not saying people here don't relate, but that is the only source, you know, of consolation in some situations. Like, for example, people will ask us, how can you laugh and smile in a situation of war, you know? And then you say, because I know there is a God. In 2003, the one Bible verse that kept playing on my mind was, and this too shall pass. So every time I sat and cried, that because I would question the work that we were doing, whether we were making impact or not, the voice would come to my head, and this too shall pass. On August 12th, when President Taylor was leaving Liberia to go to Nigeria into exile, that same voice came back to me, and this too shall pass. No one thought that man who had one of the most powerful private armies in West Africa would agree to leave Liberia for the sake of peace. I see your hand again.
Now, you have explained that the women in Liberia are more powerful.
Peace building.
Yeah, peace building. So, what is the percentage of the women because in Namibia, most people who are involved in Christianity or church activities are women. If you go to the church for Sunday worship service, if there are 3,000 people in the church, 2,500 are women.
Yeah.
Is it the same?
It's the same in Liberia, but our movement is not just Christians. It's both Christians and Muslims. The only area where we have all Christians is here in Lofa because they have a serious ethnic thing. So the women who started the movement were Christians, so the Muslim women are not involved. Because in this community, there's an unspoken law. The Christians cannot buy from the Muslims, and the Muslims cannot buy from the Christians. Tomorrow I talk about the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. On Wednesday, when I talk about what women are doing in terms of community building, we'll talk more on this. And then that will more or less be looking in depth of what women are currently doing in terms of rebuilding their community, in terms of restorative justice and peace building. Specific examples of what women have been doing and are doing now. Well, in some communities, the only thing the men will do is say, okay, go ahead, God go with you. But by allowing their wives, which this is something that is strange, allowing their wives to come, because one Muslim woman who were coming from this area, Maigidi, we have gone for a program there, and then someone asked her, Asatu, you are going home so late, it's 5 o'clock, who will cook for your husband? She said, wonders, that's how we say when something is shocking, wonders shall never end. And everyone was like, what? Since I joined this peace movement, whenever I say to my husband, I'm going to the peace field, he prepares the meal for the day, a Muslim man.
Amazing.
So that is something. So she said, today we're going to eat a water stew, but I don't mind because he is preparing it.
It ever occurred to you that a better title than general for you would be president?
Well, it has. And right now, since we started the election season, people have been coming and saying, we want you to run as representative for your constituent. We want you to run as this. But I feel it's not yet time. Everyone has been saying to me, and I know that I have a very good head for politics. In December, once we end the campaign, I'm moving to Ghana for the next 2 years. To be with my kids, and then I'm going to do a long distance master's program in South Africa in community development. Has a bit of conflict prevention within it. So I want to prepare myself, make a big comeback. Maybe 12, 14 years down the road, I'll go in for politics. But the general also, it was strange that General Abubakar gave me that name because when I worked with the ex-child soldiers, that was the name they used to call me. Because when they were misbehaving, I would enter the room, no smiling. It's either you leave this program, if they left that program, there was no hope out there for them. So once you misbehave, you were going, and nothing you will say will make me to bring you back. So they always said this woman is no nonsense person. Well, we have 5 minutes to go, and sometimes in our movement, one of the ways we tend to be energized is by singing. Singing plays a major role in what we do. It gives us hope. We do a lot of singing. A lot of us are learning now how to say the Lord's Prayer, the Quranic Lord's Prayer, because our interaction with the women, we've learned to sing Muslim songs. We dance together, and dancing is also a big part of our culture too. We dance when we are sad. We dance when we are happy. We do a lot of those things. But over the last 3 years, since we've really been working as a group, we've seen a more closer community of women in that one person's problem is another person's problem. We went to this workshop, and we do a lot of workshops, and we were working with women from the security forces. One of the songs that really became the theme song of our 5 days together was this song. It goes like this. And usually when I come to any event or I go back from any event, I like to take back new songs to my kids. So when I've had a speaking engagement, have little time left, I also like to give something that you can take back to either your kids or your grandkids. So this is a song, I hope you will learn it. It's simple, it says, loving in the name of love, let it be. Dancing in the name of love, Let it be whatever in the name of love, let it be. It goes like this. Loving in the name of love, let it be, let it be. Loving in the name of love, let it be, let it be, let it be. Umma, 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 let it be, let it be. Umma, 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 let it be. I see you picking on. So help me, let's go. Okay, so we do sitting or standing. So I'm sitting already. Standing in the name of love, let it be, let it be. Standing, standing in the name of love, let it be, let it be, let it be. Umma, 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 umma. Umma, 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 let it be, let it be. Umma, 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 let it be. Clapping, clapping in the name of love, let it be, let it be. Clapping. Clapping in the name of love, let it be, let it be, let it be. Umma, 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 let it be, let it be. Umma, 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 let it be. Dancing in the name of love, let it be, let it be. Dancing, dancing in the name of love, let it be, let it be, let it be. Umma, 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 umma. Umma, 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 let it be, let it be. Umma, 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 let it be. Sitting, sitting in the name of love, let it be. Finish. So I want to say thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.